In this hour of the show, we will be looking back to American television of the early 1950s, a time when this medium was growing explosively, both in its reach and in its impact on American culture. And the guest for the program is Thomas Dougherty. He's professor in the American Studies Department at Brandeis University, which is in Waltham, Massachusetts, not far from Boston. He's also chair of the film studies program at Brandeis, and he's authored a book that we will talk about this morning titled Cold War, Cool Medium, the subtitle Television, McCarthyism, and American Culture. And it is published by the Columbia University Press. And I think that for a lot of people, there will indeed be this association between Joseph McCarthy and the medium of television. And they would say that certainly one of the things that television did at this time was to offer to McCarthy a national platform from which to put out his message. So they might indeed argue that it facilitated, that somehow television facilitated both the Cold War, thinking and McCarthyism. While that is no doubt true, I think Professor Dougherty would say that it indeed also worked the other way, because television was the place where McCarthy, his downfall was on display as well for the people of the United States. So we'll talk about that, some other things, and of course, whatever questions and comments that people have, they're certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. We just ask people to try to be brief so that we can keep the program going and get in as many people as possible. Of course, though, as I say, anybody's welcome to join the conversation. Professor Dougherty, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
One of the things that's really striking here when you talk about the spread and the reach of television, you offer these numbers here in the book, is that in 1949, only one out of every 10 American homes had a television. Just 10 years later, in 1959, 9 out of 10 homes had a TV. That's an amazing growth in the spread of this medium in just a decade.
Yeah, it's really amazing how quickly TV takes over as what you might call the mass medium of choice. And it's not to say that radio is not important or that people aren't still going to the movies, but increasingly television really becomes the form for American democracy. And you might even think by the mid-50s, there's sort of what you might call a tipping point where, Eric Barnow, the great TV historian, has a wonderful line where he says that after 1954, and that's the year of the Army McCarthy hearings and the year of the great Edward R. Murrow shows, few people now dared to be without a television set. Mm-hmm. Although there are some families that surely did hold out, increasingly by even the mid-1950s, TV is, the dominant and most influential medium in American culture.
It seems that it was very clear to a lot of people almost from the very start, after the war, when television really started to take off. People understood that television would, the effect of television would be far greater than any of the mass media that had come before it. And yet you wonder what, because before radio was there, everybody had a radio, and radio was the thing, perhaps again was the first thing that nationally unified the country in the sense that everybody could be sitting there and listening to the radio at the same time, and whether that was they were listening to Franklin Roosevelt or they were listening to The Shadow or whatever it was, it was something that brought everybody together. But television, somehow it's different.
Yeah, well, it's always the difference between, having those images in your room and the simultaneity of the experience. And as you know, some of that, and a lot of that actually happens in the age of radio from around 1930 onward. But when you can add images to the audio, you get clearly a much more visceral, intense experience. And just the whole magic of that is something that I think a modern viewer has trouble recapturing in the age of cable. The word TV is, or television is, the same word we use for 50 years of this medium, But if you're looking at TV in 1950, it's really the difference between, say, sound cinema and silent cinema compared to the television today that young people are familiar with. We have a whole generation now that doesn't know what, you know, horizontal hold is, or, you know, never manipulated rabbit ears, or have had to, you know, trudge across their carpeting to actually manually turn a television dial. And that the medium that I tried to recapture in the late 40s and early 50s is really a special kind of creature in American history. It's sort of before three-network hegemony really came in strong in the late 50s and throughout the 60s. It's well in advance of cable. And it's this period where a lot of TV is live. A lot of it is unpreserved and therefore forgotten. And TV and American culture are just beginning the tango that they're, of course, going to dance for the rest of the century and on into the next one.
Clearly there is some kind of a qualitative difference in the way people encounter television if you compare that with print or even with radio. And that clearly is what Mr. McLuhan was talking about when he said that there were media that were cool and there were media that were hot.
Yeah.
And I guess that, and in fact, one of my colleagues had raised this question in my mind. We were talking about it, and maybe it's because we're in radio that we would even think about such a thing. But when you think about particularly some of the themes that played out in the Cold War, you wonder, well, what if there was no television?
Yeah.
What if radio was the way that people were talking about this? Would somehow the whole debate, the way people thought about it, would it have been any different?
Mm-hmm. And that's a great hypothetical, because if you think of some of the radio personalities that were influential during the 1930s, on the one hand you have the salutary progressive characters, very conversational guys like Roosevelt, who in his famous fireside chats talked to people one-on-one in a very kind of rational, cool manner. And then at the other extremes you got guys like Father Coughlin, the famous demagogic priest, or Huey Long, giving out another kind of message entirely. And perhaps McCarthy, had he just merely been a radio character, might have been much more effective than he was on television, because when he starts to go on TV, there's something about sort of the visceral hotness of his personality that begins turning people off in a way that in some ways has nothing to do with ideology. The minute you see a character like that for extended periods of time on television, your instinct is to draw back, because the character's so aggressive and so overbearing, where you tend to embrace somebody who's cooler and more patrician, whether it's a journalist, a broadcaster like Edward R. Murrow, or the famous lawyer in the Army McCarthy hearings, Joseph Welch.
Mm. Well, it's certainly interesting when you go back and you look at some of the things that television brought into people's homes at this time early on, and what was going on in the world. And I guess I was maybe not surprised, but to read that one of the things that television brought into people's homes was nuclear tests.
Yeah.
There was live coverage of, in some cases, nuclear explosions, and they also showed film of the first hydrogen bomb. Probably if they could have done that one live, they would have.
Yeah.
That it's really very striking that those sorts of things, somehow seems to me it's striking that those sorts of things would have been presented that way, and one wonders exactly what people made of that when they saw mushroom clouds live from the nuclear tests out in Nevada there on their television set.
Yeah, and this is sort of one of just the curious points about the history of the 20th century in terms of our visual imagery, that we tend to remember the history best, obviously, that we have the best images of. So counterintuitively, I think our imagination and our memory visually of, say, the Great Depression in the 1930s, or certainly the Second World War, the event that was in the 20th century that was most covered by celluloid, is much more vivid than some of our memories of the early 1950s, because this was an age before the invention of videotape, which doesn't really come in until 1956, and it doesn't start going online with great regularity until the late 50s and early 60s. And so if things weren't kinescoped, would be the term, that is, 16-millimeter photograph or 16-millimeter record of a television screen, unless you did that and kinescoped the image, it was flat gone. So a lot of the early 1950s is lost to our visual historical memory because we simply don't have the images. And so we don't have many of the images of the live nuclear test, and we actually don't have many images of live presidential addresses, believe it or not. Now, when I was doing this project, one of the things I was surprised about is that I'd read accounts either in the motion picture or television trade press about Truman giving a talk or Eisenhower or Nixon. And, you know, I'd want to see it, and I'd call up the presidential libraries, and they wouldn't have an image of a talk that Truman gave. So Truman's 1948 inaugural address was televised locally, and I believe it went as far as New York, but we have no preserved record of it. And there are all those amazing moments from the late 40s and early 50s that just have been lost to the ether. And the nuclear, the coverage of some of the early atomic tests in Yucca Flats are some of those images that are just flat, seem to be gone.
Yeah. Something else that I thought was really fascinating, and I guess I particularly thought about it because yesterday, and I think I have this right, yesterday I believe was that the 20th anniversary of the airing of the made-for-television movie The Day After.
Oh.
Which was very, if people remember this, it was very controversial. It was a movie about what would happen if there was a nuclear war between the Soviet Union and the United States. And it was controversial because it was clearly intended to get people to think about how bad nuclear weapons were and the fact that we really should do something about them and we should be talking with the Soviet Union and trying to get rid of them. And it was pointed to as an indication of the fact that, of course, the television networks, we know that they're liberal and they have this liberal agenda. And I was really struck by one of the things along this line, though, that you write about in the book. And this was a film, a live primetime television drama that was done. This was in 1954, interestingly enough, on ABC.
Yeah.
This was a program about New York City being hit by a hydrogen bomb. And the story of one woman in particular dealing with the after effects. And I just thought, well, first of all, I thought it must have scared the heck out of people in 1954. But I thought that the interesting parallel between that and essentially the same story.
Yeah.
And I really wondered about how people reacted to that in 1954.
Well, you can imagine. People were flat terrified. And the real uptick you get in this nuclear terror, of course, is after the invention of the hydrogen bomb. That, as horrific as the atomic bomb was that ended the Second World War, we could kind of get our mind around it as a really big TNT explosion. And if you looked at the metaphors, people would say, well, it's equivalent to 10,000 tons of TNT or whatever. And if you looked at the aerial shots of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they didn't look all that different from, you know, those famous images of Berlin or Dresden, for example. But when the hydrogen bomb comes online in the early 1950s, that's what really scares the bejesus out of people, because there you actually have the prospect of nuclear annihilation of the entire species. And there's a wonderful TV moment, in fact, that commemorates this with Edward R. Murrow's See It Now on the very day that the hydrogen bomb is announced by the Atomic Energy Commission. The See It Now happens to be live that Saturday, and they are getting the news live, and the reporter coming in on Edward R. Murrow's show is extremely braced by this prospect, and he comments, there's no joy at all in his voice. And the other thing that this atmosphere does for you is it gives you an appreciation for the palpable terror so many Americans rightly felt in the early days of the Cold War as they're confronting these images. And also the prospect of course, the Soviet Union is also a country with nuclear weapons, if not at that moment, hydrogen weapons.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Thomas Doherty. He's professor in the American Studies Department at Brandeis University. He's also chair of the Film Studies Program and has written a lot about media and has a new book out that's titled Cold War, Cool Medium, Television, McCarthyism, and American Culture, and it's published by the Columbia University Press. It's out there if you would like to take a look at it. And, of course, questions here, welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222. 1-800-242-9455. So we've talked about the fact that images of nuclear annihilation were present there. They were there on the medium. And I guess when it comes to the Cold War at early television, another image that will be linked, those things will be linked in people's mind with Joe McCarthy.
Yeah.
Although, interestingly enough, as you point out, if you look at what McCarthy was doing, he himself was not particularly interested in investigating the entertainment industry.
Yeah, this is really one of the great misconceptions, and it's sort of one of those misconceptions that you can't blast out of the public imagination with dynamite, that the phrase McCarthyism has become the all-purpose rubric for any kind of domestic repression of thought or discourse during the Cold War, you know, a period that lasts from 1946 to, you know, well, sometime in the end of the 60s, if you're talking about sort of the real oppression of, you know, what you might call aberrant ideologies. McCarthy's own tenure, as it were, is a really remarkably brief period. It's like from 1950 to 1954 is what you might call the height of his power. So in a sense, McCarthyism is this phenomenon that both predates McCarthy and postdates McCarthy. So he's given, in a sense, too much credit or blame for all the things that we kind of clump under the rubric of McCarthyism. The thing that's probably the most widely misconceived is the point you just mentioned about you know, McCarthy's relationship to the entertainment industry. The McCarthy Committee, sometimes called the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, is often confused with the House Committee on Un-American Activities, which of course has the first famous series of hearings into Hollywood in October 1947, basically 3 years before McCarthy comes on the scene as an anti-communist Cold Warrior. So that's always one of those misconceptions, you know, that the House Un-American Activities Committee is conflated with Joe McCarthy. McCarthy's targets were by and large intramural, that he was concerned with investigating folks in the State Department and later with the U.S. Army, sometimes with the U.S. Information Agency and other, you know, the Voice of America. But generally, he went after the executive branch, which was okay during his first couple of years in doing this from 50 to 52. But, of course, when Eisenhower is elected and the Republicans take over the Senate, he's sort of engaged in you know, shooting his fellow Republicans, and that's when he really starts to become more trouble than he's worth for people in Washington.
Yeah, it was the it was HUAC, the House Committee on Un-American Activities, that was involved in investigating Hollywood, and
right.
People I'm sure will be familiar with the term blacklist.
Yeah,
that there were a number of people who were said to have been involved in left-wing politics, and as a result they couldn't work in the industry. The same thing did happen in television, and although perhaps it doesn't have quite the same place in people's imagination that the Hollywood blacklist, the one that affected people who worked in movies, did. But there certainly was a television blacklist, and what you call the founding document of that was something called Red Channels, which allegedly listed people working in television who were communists.
Yeah, Red Channels comes out in June 1950, and what it is this pamphlet, which is kind of a compilation of these newsletters an anti-communist outfit called American Business Consultants has been putting out for a couple of years, and it puts between covers the names of 151 radio and television performers, entertainers, some directors and screenwriters, who are alleged to have Communist Party affiliations or like-minded opinions. The idiom of the day would have been fellow travelers, that is, people who, although not necessarily Communist Party members, certainly hewed to the party line on most domestic and foreign affairs. So when Red Channels is published on June 22nd in 1950, it's the official beginning, as it were, of the TV blacklist, because it puts these people's names, you know, between covers. By coincidence, that's also the week that the Korean War erupts overseas, and it's also the same month that Julius Rosenberg is arrested domestically. So you have this sort of concatenation of events in which you got a hot war overseas firing off. You got the intensity of the Cold War domestically firing off, and you have red channels being published. And one of the curious phenomena, or maybe appropriate phenomena, of the post-war era, and the HUAC committee hearings of 47 is another, is also, I think, part of this same matrix, is that increasingly Americans, when they want to talk about anything, sex, violence, ideology, you name it, they will go to the media. Because during the Second World War, we learned in America, in a way we'd never known before, that film and radio and television later is a powerful medium for the communication of political values, our culture, and increasingly when we want to talk about something in our culture, we use the media to talk about it. So that's why I think HUAC goes after Hollywood in 47, and why private interest groups and the government eventually starts looking at the television medium as a place where perhaps subversive activities and subversive ideologies can be communicated to the American people.
Yeah. You present in the book a couple of case studies of how this worked and how one actor in particular was, his career was destroyed. In fact, his life was destroyed by it. And then another, perhaps better known, a case where a performer significantly confronted it head on, and perhaps because she was extremely popular, that helped, was able to ride it out. In the first case, it was an actor named Philip Loeb, who yeah. was a performer on the show The Goldbergs. I don't know how many people will remember it, before my time, a program that had been a radio show about this, about a Jewish family living in New York that then made the transition, as a number of radio shows did, from radio to television. And this particular actor was singled out, and they fired him. And he was dogged by these allegations, had a very difficult time for the rest of his life. Eventually, he committed suicide, in part because of that. So here is a particular case in which that allegation clearly destroyed this man's career and his life.
Yeah, Philip Loeb is a real tragic character, and I think he's probably the most poignant and most tragic of all the Blacklist stories. I said in the book that every Blacklist story is like those families in Tolstoy. They're all unhappy in a different way, and Loeb's is clearly the most unhappiest, if you will, because he does end up actually committing suicide. Maybe some of your listeners have seen the Woody Allen movie, The Front, directed by Martin Ritt, and the Zero Mostel character in that movie, who jumps out of a hotel window, is sort of a loosely based on Philip Loeb, who, as you noted, played the father on the long-running radio and then television show The Goldbergs. He was named in Red Channels. The sponsor of The Goldbergs got cold feet, dropped the show. It was picked up for renewal on NBC, but contingent on Loeb no longer being in the cast, because in these days the sponsors controlled the shows totally, and every sponsor had sort of an ethos of what was called 100% acceptability. They never wanted their name associated with anything that would alienate anybody. They wanted total acceptability. So if you alienated any group, they would tend to back away from the product, and certainly no American company wanted their product associated with anything to do with communist subversion. So they insist that that Loeb be taken off the show. And the auteur of the series, the woman who played Molly Goldberg, the lovable Yiddish mama of the show, was faced with the prospect of either firing Philip Loeb and letting a friend go and caving into the pressure, or not firing Loeb and having her show basically be blasted off the air and take her livelihood away and the livelihood of everyone else, which is really an anguishing position she was put in. She ultimately decides to let Loeb go. He is blacklisted from much of the entertainment business. He gets some jobs in Broadway, but is really living foot to mouth. And it was so poignant when I was doing the research on this, because I went and got Philip Loeb's FBI file, which you can do. You can get these things through the Freedom of Information Act and read a fairly extensive litany of FBI memos that are tracking this guy around the country as he's touring in various Broadway shows when he can manage to get the job. And Now, every 6 months, there's an FBI agent who's going to the shows and filing a report. And the very last page in Philip Loeb's FBI file is from August 1955, and it's the FBI agent who's sort of assigned to his case. And the FBI agent realizes after following this guy around for 3 or 4 years, he's no threat to national security, and he goes out on a limb and recommends that Loeb be taking off their list of security risks. And that's the last piece of paper, and it's dated like August 25th, and several days later, Loeb goes into a hotel room and commits suicide, of course having no way of knowing that even the FBI has decided that he's no threat to national security. So this story is really at the extreme ends of tragedy. A more humorous story, if you will, and one that is at the other end of the experience is Lucille Ball's story. Believe it or not, Lucille Ball actually had a brush with the House Un-American Activities Committee herself at the height of her fame when she and Desi had the number one show in the country, and she was sort of America's sweetheart. She's really, when you think of the stature of Lucille Ball in terms of her ratings and just how popular she was in the 1950s, she's, you know, if you adjust it for inflation in modern-day Nielsen, she's probably the biggest star the medium's ever had. And in the early 1930s, mid to 36, 37, she had allegedly, or actually she really did, indicate her willingness to vote the Communist Party ticket. She had signed a voting registration card. And so this is regurgitated in the early 1950s at a time and when it's a lot less politically correct. She's called secretly before the House Committee on Un-American Activities, and the news is leaked by the reporter Walter Winchell on his television show, which he had Sunday night. And for the next week, there's just a flurry of speculation about who this person is and exactly what's going on. Friday, the story breaks in the press that it's Lucille Ball who's been accused. She and Desi give a tearful press conference about it. That night at the taping of their show, Desi goes out to the audience and says the only thing red about this girl is her hair, and even that's not genuinely red. And the audience embraces her. And 2 days later, the story kind of blows over. And Lucy just sort of strides above the whole communist smear in a way that almost no one else in the 1950s managed to do.
Yeah. We have a couple callers here. We'll bring them into the conversation, and I should introduce again our guest, Thomas Doherty. He's professor in the American Studies Department at Brandeis University. He is also chair of the Film Studies program there and has written a lot about media. He is the author of the book Cold War, Cool Medium, Television, McCarthyism, and American Culture. It's published by the Columbia University Press and explores some of the content, the themes, and also the politics in television of the early 1950s here in the United States. Questions are welcome. Again, we just ask people to help us by being brief so we can get in as many folks as possible, but anyone's welcome into the conversation. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Champaign County here to start us off, line one. Hello.
Hi. There's so many interesting anecdotes. I wanted to know whether you cover the fact that J. Edgar Hoover was apparently blue-penciling scripts for G-Man, the radio series, and that went on into the FBI TV series? You're aware of that or cover that in your book?
Hoover's, he did have a lot of public attention to TV, that in the beginning of the 1930s, Hoover realized how powerful radio could be and the newsreels as a way to solidify his own power in the FBI. And the FBI had a very powerful public relations campaign, as it were. Hoover himself didn't do much of this in the 30s or 40s. Later on with a series in the 1960s with Efren Zimbrist Jr., the FBI, he took a more active role. I think that the show in the 50s that is most associated with the FBI is something called I Led Three Lives, which some of your listeners might recall, a show based on the true life adventures of a fellow named Nathaniel Philbrick, or Herbert Philbrick, rather. And Herbert Philbrick was a triple agent. He was an advertising executive who joined the Communist Party on behalf of the FBI. So the story every week told about his adventures infiltrating the Communist Party but he had to do so because he was a true American patriot. Philbrick really was sort of an ad hoc, not an official FBI agent, but he was an informer for the FBI. The show was often confused as being sort of an official FBI production, although Hoover did his best to deny it because the show didn't have the official FBI imprimatur. But that's the show I think is most associated with that sort of a Cold War FBI infiltrating the communist threat in America scenario. Very popular in his time, by the way, Dave.
Yeah. There's been a recent full-length memoir by a woman who was expatriate, and I'm forgetting her name right now, but she tells an anecdote
Bentley,
about...
Bentley, I believe?
Excuse me?
Is it the Elizabeth Bentley memoir?
Sounds possible, yeah. She tells an anecdote about them having a meeting in Hollywood and being tipped off that it was being surveilled by none other than Marilyn Monroe or something like that, which is an interesting little anecdote. I note that Dalton Trumbo's son has a off Broadway work called Red, White, and Blacklisted. Now I don't know if that's well wrought and well put on, but it's interesting to hear that one of the people that was most affected by the blacklist is.
Yeah, well, Trumbo gets off better than a lot of people. He's one of the original Hollywood Ten, of course. Not really having all that much to do with TV. He's blacklisted in 1947. As part of that first wave, he's the one that had the great line that someone asked him, "How do you know you were blacklisted?" And he said, "My agent told me, my wife told me, and my landlord told me." But Trumbo is so talented that he very quickly starts getting work under the table in the guise of fronts and pseudonyms. And in 1956, he's actually given an Academy Award under an assumed name, Robert Rich. And this is By 56, it's an open secret that many of these many of these blacklisted writers are working under assumed names or fronts. Trumbo goes on local television in L.A. and says that, yeah, he's the guy who just got the Oscar under an assumed name, and that clip is picked up by CBS in New York and broadcast nationally. So it's really an open secret by even 56 that the original Hollywood Ten, at least, or some of them are working under the table in Hollywood. TV doesn't open up like that until much later. A key moment and a key date might be 1964 with a show that perhaps some of your listeners do remember called The Defenders with E.G. Marshall and Robert Reed, where they play a father-son lawyer team. And in January of that year, the Defenders on television does an episode called Blacklist, which is about a blacklisted actor played by Jack Klugman. And that's the first time that TV drama addresses the issue full-on. And that's, of course, several years after Hollywood has more or less broken the blacklist of 1947 that was inaugurated in 47.
Could you mention again Red Channels and how it came about, what kind of right-wing groups were funding it, and was there any...
Well, Red Channels...
Thanks, I'll hang up.
Yeah, Red Channels was the pamphlet that is kind of the greatest hits collection of a newsletter called Counterattack. And there were a lot of these newsletters that were published in the late 40s and early 50s listing alleged communists in the entertainment industry. There's a File 13, I mentioned Counterattack. There's a guy named Myron C. Fagan who published a lot of pamphlets as well. The American Legion had one. The Catholic War Veterans had one. And virtually anybody with a mimeograph machine and a typewriter, sometimes was publishing lists of various people. And Red Channels was sort of in some ways, the best documented one, because they would list the perpetrator's name and then have a list of offenses. And the offenses were, we might think of them as fairly benign, but they were kind of authenticatable by and large, and in the sense that the editors had looked at back issues of the Daily Worker or Masses and Mainstream, Communist Journal, and seen these actors publish letters of support or take out ads in support of various causes they considered communist. So the anti-communist campaign of this time is kind of this bizarre amalgam of government agencies like the House Committee on Un-American Activities, private groups like the American Legion or the folks who did Red Channels, and some newspaper reporters, frankly, who and they were all communicating together and publishing names and making insinuations. And the government always has the power of subpoena, so you got sort of that wedge there. And the pressure groups have the power to pressure sponsors. So this is sort of how the system works throughout most of the 1950s, in TV at least.
Okay, let's go to Bloomington, Indiana next, line four. Hello.
Hi. While you're talking about television performers being blackballed in the early days of television, what about the systematic blackballing of both Rush Limbaugh and Dr. Laura Schlesinger? In much more recently, in recent years, they were blackballed. Rush Limbaugh had a very popular television program, which was exiled to the television time slots after midnight. And despite the fact that he was consistently broadcast after midnight, they wouldn't let him be broadcast at a decent hour. He would get higher ratings and the popular comedy shows, but if any television station broadcast him at a decent hour, they were threatened. The few times when some brave station owner would broadcast him at a decent hour, his ratings would soar, and then they were threatened and threatened until they moved him back into the exiled after midnight time slot. That's real blackballing.
The caller makes a reasonable point. That is. Both sides of the political spectrum use these tactics, these pressure group tactics, to sort of to go after characters whose ideology they disagree with. And I actually have no problem with that. That my objection would be is when the state starts intervening, when you actually have a House committee with subpoena powers or a government agency with investigative powers going after people, that's when I do think it becomes really sinister. But the normal things that American citizens do to organize and voice their opinions against media corporate entities, that's fine. That's the way our system works. So if a group of gay Americans wants to get together and protest Dr. Laura Schlesinger because of the opinions that she's expressed about homosexuals that they don't like, that's fine, and they can go after sponsors or networks or affiliates, and that's the way our system operates. And if people who support President Reagan and find that this miniseries The Reagans, which has been in the news lately, is an hallucination and a smear against a president they consider to be great, then by all means go after CBS. That's the way our system works.
Let's see if I've got this right.
Yeah,
it's okay when the program managers, when the television establishment blackballs people, that's all right.
No, I didn't.
But when the government, who has reason to believe, they have investigative agencies who can actually get evidence. They know when someone is sinister. So when they blackball, when they issue a warning that this is a sinister somebody who's doing something that is actually hurting the country, it may be hurting the country. I doubt very seriously whether a conservative point of view being broadcast on television would hurt the country very much.
Well, I don't think that the government has the right to make those kind of decisions when you're talking about free expression in the media. I think you have every right in the world to voice your objections to Laura Schlesinger or Rush Limbaugh or to a liberal media elite you see as suppressing conservative notions. That's fine. I actually also don't think that Rush Limbaugh has much trouble getting an audience. He's an amazing radio announcer. My own sense of what happened to him on TV is not that he was blacklisted by the television industry, who I think if he were getting great ratings, he'd be on TV, was that, as we were talking about earlier in the show with David, that Limbaugh is a hot personality. He's great on radio, but he's too overpowering on TV. And it seems like there are those personalities that can make the transition from a radio persona to a TV persona, and that my sense is Limbaugh really wasn't one of them, that he works best behind a radio microphone. On television, I did watch the show a few times, I didn't really think he had the kind of charisma that he has on his radio show.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is here, one thing we know is that the networks, the commercial broadcasters, they're going to put on whatever's going to make money for them. For example, I was just kind of surprised the other night to tune to CBS and see a Victoria's Secret lingerie show going on.
Yeah, you watched it purely for scholarly reasons.
I have to admit that I just caught the very end as I switched over there to get the news.
Yeah.
I guess once again, it says that, and particularly, I guess you have to understand the environment that the over-the-air broadcasters find themselves in, increasing competition from all other sources of entertainment, and they're just struggling to hang on, and they're going to put anything on that they think is going to make them money. We have about 10 minutes left, and our guest in this part of Focus 580, again, Tom Stoherty. He's professor of American Studies at Brandeis University. He's also the chair of their film studies program there. We've been talking about his book, Cold War Cool Medium, which is about television in America in the early 50s. Questions are welcome. One of the things that I thought was interesting, again, I was struck by looking at the book, is I guess I have this idea, perhaps a lot of people will have the idea, that early on, certainly, Senator McCarthy had enough influence so that people were afraid of criticizing him at all. And I was very struck in reading the book about the very rough treatment that he got from journalists, particularly television journalists. And some of the famous venues like Face the Nation, which is still going on now, those kinds of programs, he was really hammered really hard by the reporters, and I guess I was a little bit surprised by that.
Yeah, I was too, and in fact, the thing that kind of inspired this book, I was doing some other project, and I was at the Library of Congress, and for some reason, the archivist showed me this show called American Form of the Air. She asked if I wanted to see it. The guest was McCarthy on the particular episode. It's from December 1953, and it was a live political show in which studio audience members asked a politician questions, and it was a different politician every week. And this particular episode had McCarthy as the guest. And the studio audience is, maybe there's some ringers in there, but they kind of look like your average American from the 1950s. And to a man and woman, every one of them gets up and gives McCarthy serious grief. This woman who looks to be kind of your stereotypical image of the nice young 50s lady with the white glove asks McCarthy whether he thinks that a man is guilty or innocent until proven guilty, and McCarthy says, "Of course," and then she just comes back at them, "Then why do you treat people guilty before they're proven innocent?" An American Legion guy gets up and criticizes McCarthy. And then in one of those weird flash forwards that you sometimes experience watching these documents, a guy gets up and says, "Senator McCarthy, my name's John Sirica. I'm a lawyer here in town." And of course it's, the young lawyer who will become John Sirica of Watergate hearings fame. And he asks McCarthy an aggressive question as well. And you do get this sense that the kind of the memory of what a lot of maybe historians on the left, I think, a little too glibly call the McCarthy terror or the era of the American Inquisition, is just a little overstated. And that TV, although certainly nothing like the medium it is today, and certainly not totally free, was a lot more complicated and complex, even in issues involving McCarthyism, than popular memory is sometimes recalled.
And your bottom line is, just to round this out, that while indeed you might argue that television helped to make McCarthy, it also helped to undo him.
Oh, absolutely, because McCarthy is in the business, in the end, of restraining discourse, of restraining thought, of restraining expression. And TV, not because it's has its heart in the right place necessarily, but because of its commercial interest, needs to fill airtime. So TV is in the business, it seems to me, generally, of expanding expression, expanding discourse, expanding narratives. So I think they were destined to conflict eventually, and when it came to the head in 1954, with guys like Edward R. Murrow and later the Army of McCarthy hearings, that the two of them were inevitably in conflict and that TV would inevitably win out because in the end Americans would rather have their televisions than Joseph McCarthy.
We're getting close to the end. We have a couple minutes. We have several callers. We'll get at least one. The first one in line is Chicago in line one. Hello.
Yeah. Hi. Just a couple of pieces of information. The guy who bankrolled the Red Channels was sued for defamation of character and that sort of thing, and he lost his case, cost him several $1 million, and he went bankrupt, lost his supermarkets that he owned up in the Syracuse, New York area. The other piece of information is that I knew a guy who was working on his master's thesis in political science, and he interviewed the members of the House Un-American Activities Committee and found them all a bunch of ne'er-do-wells, a combination of drunkards and stupid people and venal people, without exception. I don't understand why the newspaper reporters never revealed this, never got onto these guys and, you know, brought them out into the open. That's all I have to say.
Fair enough. I think the person that the caller is referring to was actually a fellow named Lawrence Johnston. And he was, as the guy said, a supermarket owner in Syracuse, New York. And he wasn't really part of Red Channels. He was another one of those players in the, you know, the great pressure group matrix of anti-communist pressure groups. He was sued Aware Incorporated, actually, a kind of Red Channels-like offshoot, was sued by a guy named John Henry Falk, and he is the character that really breaks the blacklist, a guy of real courage and tenacity, who, when he was named and blacklisted, took Aware Incorporated to court, took Lawrence Johnston to court, and in the early 1960s received what at the time was the greatest jury award for this kind of defamation. Ironically, Lawrence Johnston is found dead in his hotel room the day the verdict comes back.
We'll try real quick to get another caller in Chicago here, line four. Hello.
How you doing?
Good.
I think McCarthy was just a little ahead of its time because it seems to me like the country is more ready for a McCarthy thing with this Patriot Act and stuff, that the country has to be more in a sense that we're children, the government is our father, our government is our parents, just like that guy who was supporting Rush Limbaugh. You know, the people aren't supposed to be able to have any discernment. Only the government has that power. That means they're the parents and we're the children.
Well, a final thought, Professor Daugherty?
Well, I think, one of the things about America in the post-9/11 era that might make us more sympathetic and understanding of the Cold War era is that most of us now have, a sense of the importance of national security and the sense that there are people out there who want to fly airplanes into our buildings, and that because of that, some of the old acceptance maybe, or some of the, if you're talking about the balance between civil rights and national security, in a pre-9/11 era, we would always choose civil rights. In a post-9/11 era, the decision might not be as easy as it once was. And that's, I think, just the difference between really feeling that fear in your bones as people did in the late 40s and early 50s and having it just being an imaginative construct.
Mm. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. And again, if people who are interested, you'd like to go back and think a little bit and read about television of the early 1950s, whether you were there or not in front of the set, you might look at this book we've mentioned. It's titled Cold War, Cool Medium by our guest, Thomas Daugherty. He's professor of American Studies at Brandeis University. Professor Daugherty, thanks very much.
Hey, my pleasure, David. Thank you.